This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Midrash tells two stories, one to do with the Tilas Yadayim, with washing before the Suudo, and one to do with Mayim Achronim, washing after the Suudo, washing after a meal. The first story concerns the Sha'at HaShmad, the time when there were decrees against the practice of Judaism, and there was a restaurant owner who, in order to remain, he was a Marana. They were all the Yidden who retained the Yiddishkeit were Maranas, and this restaurant owner wanted to provide kosher food for those who wanted kosher food, but he would be caught. That was a crime. So he used to sell tray for food as well. So if a goy came in, the goy got tray for food, and there was no indication that he was in fact a Jew providing kosher food. And his guidelines used to watch out. If a person came in, all the people looked the same. Nobody looked like a Jew or a Gentile. There was no way of discerning them. So he used to watch them. If they washed before the meal and said a brocha, then he knew they were Jewish, and he made sure that their food was kosher. If they didn't, then he used to give them non-kosher food. And that way he was safe. Came a man who didn't wash and didn't make a bracha. And when he goes to pay his bill after the meal, he says, why so much? In those days, trefa meat was more expensive than kosher meat. So it was a Sha'at HaShmad, there was no demand for kosher meat. So he said, yesterday I paid 8, why are you charging me 10 today? Says the restaurateur, yesterday you had kosher meat, today you had treif meat, it was more. He says, treif meat? What do you mean treif meat? He says, I watched, you didn't wash your hands, you didn't say a bracha, how must I know you're Jewish? That's the first story. A peculiar story, because apart from anything, he was obviously at the restaurant the day before. So how difficult is it for the restaurateur to know that he's Jewish after all? Number two, there's a con man, and his trick goes as follows. He watches people's hands when they've finished eating. After lunchtime, he stands outside their house, and by looking at their hands very closely, he can tell what they had for lunch. Then he goes to the wife and he says, I've been sent by your husband for A, B, or C to get a signed blank check or to give me the ring or whatever. And your husband said that the sign I should give you, that you should know that the message is genuine, something which only he and you know, and that is that we had bean stew for lunch. She says, I know you had bean stew for lunch, is that right? She says, yes, that's right. So, see, your husband said. And she gives the ring, or she gives the money, and the husband gets very furious about that, and in anger kills his wife. Peculiar story. So you see, says the Midrash, that if you don't do Mayim Achronim, it's like killing someone. Very, very weird. I always find it amusing and entertaining. I suppose different people get their entertainment in different ways. I get my entertainment, or part of my entertainment, by wondering how people who learn superficially, what they do when they read something like this. And then I go into hours of imagination. What do people say they learn if they read it? What do they think? Is this the Torah? These absurdities? And people accept it. They read these things, they read them in translations, they read them in the original, and they turn the page and carry on. And it's not just the Midrashim that need such careful analysis to make any kind of sense out of them. Even the Chumash, the Tanakh itself. Unless one analyzes it and understands it with depth and with care, how do people relate to it? Very, very peculiar. How does somebody read such a Midrash? What does it mean? You've all read the Midrash. I expected to come in and find faces of either amusement or perplexity. What you would either find it comical, or you would find it absurd. And they started a thing called the Theatre of the Absurd. I suppose they started in the 1940s, is when it really started. It became popular in the 50s and 60s. This is like right out of the Theatre of the Absurd. It could, Lahavdil, have been written by Beckett or Eugene and UNESCO, one of these crazy people. It doesn't sound like a Midrash, it doesn't sound like a Chazal. Painful, not doing my machronim is like killing somebody, because you heard what happened, one day somebody died. What does it mean? And that's why Lekach Hizir HaKadosh Baruch Yisrael, that's why Hashem warns Yisrael, Afilu b'mitzvah kalo, be careful even about the light mitzvahs. Ki lo yedov areiku mikem, ki hu chayechem. These are not light things, these are serious. Life depends on these little mitzvahs. Afilu d'var mitzvah sha'ato reyoto areiku v'kalo. Even a little mitzvah which you see as empty and light. Bo chayim v'arichus yomim, there's life and length of days in it. Because look at these stories. Somebody had treif because he didn't do mayim rishonim. Somebody murdered because he didn't do mayim achronim. Look how serious these mitzvahs are. Is that the reason for the mitzvahs? So that we shouldn't come to these kind of stories? It just doesn't make sense. The whole medrash doesn't make sense at all. So we have to make sense of it. That's the beauty of Torah. At least we know that if it doesn't make sense, then we haven't begun to understand what it's trying to communicate to us. Sometimes one reads something and it doesn't make sense, and one doesn't know, doesn't it make sense because the writer is mad, or doesn't it make sense because I'm mad, or doesn't it make sense because I don't understand what the writer says? There are three possibilities. And then one then has to decide whether it's worth spending time on it, if maybe all that's wrong is that I'm mad, or maybe all that's wrong is that the writer's mad. But at least when it comes to Torah, when it comes to Chazal, we know for sure that there is enormous depth, that there's a great deal of meaning and understanding in all this, and it is unlikely that we will understand even one tiny, tiny proportion of it, but we have to try and understand as much as we can. And until we've made some sense of it, we have to accept that we have no inkling as to what is being said. The human being lives two lives. He lives a public life, and he lives a private life. His public life is determined largely, or his conduct in his public life is determined largely by the expectations of the society in which he operates. He behaves in public more or less in accordance with what the people around him expect of him. His private life is different. Different societies cope with these two different lives in different ways. The Americans cope with it by saying that we can't live double lives. So we call a spade. And we let it all hang out, I think is the phrase they use, and that's how it is. Take me as I am, or it doesn't matter. You can be sitting in a subway in the United States next to somebody you've never met before, and within 3 minutes he's telling you about the argument he had with his wife last night, and the argument he had the night before, and the girlfriend he's got on the side, and his whole intimate details pouring out without shame. There is no busha. There is no feeling this is not for the public. Nothing at all. Anything that's for private is for public, and anything that's for public is for private. There is no privacy. And that's why the press is able to do what they do in America with the full encouragement of the population. They like it. They enjoy it. The breaking down of the barriers between the public and the private life. And that's why the only people who can become leaders of that nation are either tzaddikim, who wouldn't want to, or effective actors and manipulators and gangsters. Those are the only people who really can handle this dichotomy, this invasion of privacy that exists there. On the other hand, you have people like the German people, many of the continental people, the British people to a lesser degree, who take it a completely different, who go to the other extreme. And they say, in public, that's one thing, what I do in private has nothing to do with you or anybody else. And you will never come close to figuring what goes on in their private life, except their most intimate of friends. But anybody else has no idea. Is the English gentleman or the German gentleman meticulously polite, in every way courteous, outstanding in his social mannerisms, and you have no clue at all what he thinks about you, what he feels about you, what he's likely to do behind your back. You just don't know. That's the other extreme. The continental looks at the American and says, you uncultured so-and-so, no privacy, no shame, no busha, what's all this business? The American looks at the continental and says, you two-faced so-and-so, two lives, never know where I stand with you. Say one thing and mean something else. What is it all about? How can one live with such dishonesty and with such a lack of integrity? And maybe South Africans are such funny people because they're torn between the two. They've got a strong influence of American culture and a strong influence of English culture. On the one hand, we have a certain continental background here of proprietary and respect of privacy. On the other hand, for many years we've been part of the dynamic West and influenced by American literature and media to a very large extent. And we haven't really sorted ourselves out here. And we're torn between these two pressures of the public and the private life. And that's why maybe South Africans are so aggressive and so disturbed, which is a factor. Of course, there are other reasons too. We're living under enormous pressure at the moment, social pressure, political pressure. There are all sorts of things which cause it. But South Africans are very tense people at the moment and very, very aggressive people, much more so than anywhere else. And this might have something to do with that we fit in neither culture. We neither have the Americans abandon nor the years of culture and sophistication of the continental who has learned to live his double life with such superb effectiveness. What about Bilam? Where did he fit into all this? Bilam, we know, there was a vast discrepancy between his two lives. That we know. He reached the heights of prophecy, and he reached the depths of depravity. But was that evident to the public? Did the public see him only as an outstanding intellect, as a philosopher, as a spiritual man, and his private life was unknown? Only the Torah reveals it to us? Or was his private life known too? We have a clue to that in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where the Mishnah says, Chol mi sheyesh biyado gimel dvorim halolu, anybody who has these three characteristics, mitalmidov shel Avraham Avinu, shleisha dvorim acherim mitalmidov shel Bilam Harosh. Anybody who has these three characteristics is a talmid of Bilam, is a talmid of Avraham Avinu, and anybody who has their converses is a talmid of Bilam Harosh. Rebellia asks, why does it say anybody who has these three attributes is a Talmud of Avraham? Why doesn't the Mishnah just say the following three characteristics distinguish Avraham Avinu from Bilam HaRosha? Why does it say these three characteristics distinguish the disciples of Avraham Avinu from the disciples of Bilam HaRosha? Says Rebellia, because Bilam had the capacity to cover it all up. You wouldn't have seen even these three characteristics Bilam's friends and colleagues didn't see. He was a brilliant man, he was an intellect, he was a professor, he was a man of the cloth, he was a spiritual man, he was a priest, he was a prophet, and he knew how to play the part. His affair with his shias and his various other depravities, that was between him and himself. Nobody ever saw that, nobody heard about that. In those days there wasn't a press, and he could keep it to himself. Only the Torah reveals it to us, for the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to know it. So we see that Bilam HaRosha, as we start to get a picture of who this man was, and we have been doing throughout the Shabbos, we now see a further aspect of his personality, that of the continental type, whose public life reflected only the enormity of his intellect and the brilliance of his mind, the greatness of his spiritual capacity, his leadership qualities, and that's why he was consulted by the king of Moab and others. This was the man, the superb mind of the time, the person that people consulted on any major issue, any major political or social or religious or psychological problem. Bilam was the man to go to. And the fact that Bilam lived a double life was not of interest to the people of that time, just as it isn't terribly much of interest to the people of our time. You will never find a person saying, choosing what university to go to because the professor of mathematics at this university is a fine moral man and the professor of mathematics at the other university is an immoral man. That doesn't come into it. We're not interested in his morality. We're interested in whether he's a good teacher of mathematics. That's all that's important. And so it is today too, that we've got this respect for intellect irrespective of the stature of the individual in terms of morality and ethics. And so it can be, because academic stature is permanent.
once a person has attained a certain status in academics, he's got it. That's it. He's brilliant, he remains brilliant. He's a professor, he remains a professor. He's got a doctorate, he keeps his doctorate. There's no fluctuation in mental achievement. There's no fluctuation in academic achievement. One can stagnate, one can cease to progress further. But there are no violent fluctuations. The person has made it, then he's made it permanently. That's how it is. What is it that, in a funny sort of way, fascinates Bilam about Am Yisrael? But fascinates him in a way that makes him realize that he and Am Yisrael can't survive together. They are so opposite that one of them are going to have to go. Either he's going to have to be destroyed or Klal Yisrael is going to have to be destroyed. What is it that he perceives in Klal Yisrael that is so antagonistic to his very essence? We know the various chazals. He saw the way they camped according to their tribes, and no entrance of any one tent opened to the other. We know the chazal that he saw, that they got up early for shul and they put on their tzitzis and all the things that they used to do. But this medrash which you've just learnt appears to suggest that he noticed other things. And what really has this medrash to do with the whole parsha? The Midrash ends by saying, Kivan shero'o Bilam heich mishamrim Yisrael ha-mitzvahs hakalus. When Bilam saw how Yisrael keep the light mitzvahs, which light mitzvahs? The Midrash is suggesting mitzvahs such as Netzilas Yadayim, mitzvahs such as washing before the meal, mitzvahs such as Mayim Achronim, as washing after the meal. Omar, he said, Mi yuchal lekalel es eli. Who can curse these people? Sheshomrim mitzvosov, who keep his mitzvahs, God's mitzvahs, ushamoy meshusov bohem, and God's name is synthesized with them. God is a partner with them. How can one curse these people? It's like cursing God himself. Sheneimar, as it says, Hashem Elikov imoy Hashem, his God is with him. Hamekalel oisom kiilu mekalel pnei shchino sheshmoy meurot bishmo. That anybody who curses them, it's as if he curses the Shekhinah as well, because God's name is mixed up, is synthesized with their name. They're one concept. The Ribbono Shel Olam and Klal Yisrael are one. How does he perceive that? Because he watches them doing the Tilas Yadayim, because he watches them doing Mayim Achronim. What is it that he sees? Let's analyze the two stories a little bit more carefully. First story, the time of Shmad, the time of decree against the Jews, the restaurateur, running his little restaurant, standing at the counter, eyeing his customers to notice whether they go and wash, to see are they washing just for cleanliness or is it for Yiddishkeit, see whether they make a brocha, whether they mumble a brocha quietly so that nobody can see, but he can see. All he wants to see is if after they've washed, if they don't go and wash, he doesn't bother with them. But if they go and wash, he's just got to check one step further to see a moment's hesitation before they put the bread into their mouth. That moment's hesitation gives him to understand that they're mumbling a brocha. And then he knows that this is a kosher customer and he has to have kosher food. A man comes in, sits down directly without going to wash, doesn't mumble a brocha, eats the bread, and as was his way, our restaurateur serves him with tray for food. He comes to pay his bill and realizes a discrepancy between his bill today and his bill on the previous day, queries it, and the restaurateur says, today you had chaza, you had pork today, it's more expensive. He goes into a state, he can't believe it, pork? I've never eaten in my life, surely you know that I'm a Jew? He says, how must I know? You didn't wash, you didn't say a brocha. We asked the question, but he was there the day before, of course he knows he's a Jew. This story goes through Bilam's mind. Bilam sees the Jews washing and realizes what this means. He realizes firstly that the fact that this particular Jew washed his hands the day before and said his bracha the day before did not save him from chaza today. And that's a chidush for Bilam. Because in Bilam's world, if you've passed your doctorate yesterday, you remain a doctor today. That doesn't get taken away from you. If you've achieved something in the intellectual world, in the academic world, that achievement stays with you. You either go further or you stay where you are. But you don't lose it the next day. And here you have a man who keeps the halacha meticulously one day, and the next day he slips up on two little things. He must have davened that morning, and he keeps Shabbos, and he keeps kashrus. You can see how concerned he is that he's eaten chazer. It's a terrible thing. He just slipped up in one moment of rush or fear or whatever. He didn't wash before he ate. That's all. Didn't wash. It can happen. Imagine a person sitting on an aeroplane. And nowadays in the aeroplanes, you've got six people on this side and six people on this side before you can even get to a corridor. People right in front of you with their seats back in your nose. And the tray is right in front of you, and they dump food in front of you. And now you've got to go and wash. And everybody's eating on both sides of you. And wash. So you don't wash today. But make your feel like the Ribbono Shel Olam will understand. Eat without washing. Look what it brings to. A man eats treif. Good. In one particular circumstance it brings to that. But there's a message here Bilam works out. The message is that the Jew doesn't retain his status from yesterday. Today is Nochadach. Not Mura is Nochadach. Vandach is Nochadach. Today is a different day. And what I did yesterday doesn't count today. Yesterday I was a tzaddik, today I'm not. And I'm related to as though I'm not. It doesn't help. The same in the second story. Man comes home quickly for lunch. He's got to rush back to his work immediately afterwards. Eats his lunch, washes, says a brocha, says a word of divrei Torah at his table. Finishes and he looks at his watch. Ooh, he's got a meeting, he's got a rush. Forgets to do a mayim achronim, benches, rushes out. A few marks of the beans on his fingers, his fingernails which he ate. Does he know that somebody's standing outside with a telescope watching his fingers? Ah, he says, I've got someone. Beans he had. Waits till he's gone down the road, goes inside and gets his little fingers on this man's money by masquerading as an intimate friend of the man, who's been given a message by the man that his wife has to hand the money over, and the proof that his message is genuine is that he can tell the wife that they had beans for lunch. And she says, that's right. An unusual story, something which probably has never happened. But Bilam realizes it could happen. And if the man had done Mayim Achronim, it wouldn't have happened. But he's done Mayim Achronim every day of his life, only today he didn't do Mayim Achronim. Yesterday doesn't protect him. It's not that he loses the money because he didn't do Mayim Achronim. This isn't a punishment. That's not what it is. Nor is it a direct consequence. It's just a concept. Don't forget, Bilam is an intellectual par excellence. He looks at a mitzvah and he analyzes it. And he realizes that all the Mayim Achronim in the world can't make up for the one time it isn't done. And this is a new world to Bilam. He's never seen such a thing before. This amazes him. He notices the routine, the constancy, the consistency, every single day, Mayim Achronim, every single meal, Metilas Yodayim, every single meal. And all along we find that is the common thread in Chazal. When he says, Hein am kelovi yokum, this nation wakes up like a lion. Rashi brings the Chazal, Kshein imdi mishenosom, when they wake up from their sleep, Shachris in the morning, Hemis Gabrim, Kelavi, they become powerful like a lion. Lachtoifis ha-mitzvahs. And what motivates them to get a mitzvah quickly? Lilbush tzitzis, to put on their tzitzis. Likre shema, to say the shema. Laniach tfilin, to put on tfilin. Balaylo ha-mitosu yad shuoichel. At night he doesn't lie on his bed until he's eaten, as the lion does. Mechabuko mazik abolotafo ketzad. How does the Jew act as the lion who doesn't go to sleep without eating? Korei Shema mitosu, he says Kriya Shema, Mafkid Ruchu biyadamokim, and so on. The routines, every single morning they do this. Not just once or twice, not just on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, not just on Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh, and Shiva also Betambas and Tisha B'Av. Every single morning, that same routine, they wake up, get up quickly, Talis, Tfilin, Shema, Davening, They come to the meal, Netilas Yadayim, Brocha, Mayim Achronim, benching every single time, over and over and over again. That's what fascinates Bina. The consistency, the regularity, the routine, all the time. And what happens, says Bilam to himself, if they miss it once? If they miss it once, they're in mortal danger. It doesn't help that they're part of the routine 99 out of the 100 times. A routine loses all its meaning if you miss it once. A routine is a different concept. And once you've missed it once, it isn't a routine anymore. And Bilam pictures to himself a situation in which missing the routine, he doesn't think of Olam Haba, and he doesn't think of Schar and Oinesh, he thinks of a social situation. And he pictures to himself a social situation where missing the mitzvah can cost a life, irrespective of how many times you've done it in the past, irrespective of what other mitzvahs you do. This little tiny mitzvah I missed, and look what it can cost. That's what Bilam says to himself. And he finds that fascinating in Klal Yisrael. But it goes further. What is the connection between these two stories? Of course, one's Netilas Yadayim and one's Mayim Achronim. They both have to do with the meal, washing before, washing afterwards. That's the halachic connection. But what is the conceptual connection? What is the intellectual connection between these two concepts? I think most of you are aware that I'm very concerned about the neglect of intellectual application to the understanding of the Torah. There are many reasons for it, and we don't need to go into these reasons now, but the tendency at the moment is intellectual analysis, that's for university, that's when you're studying philosophy and literature and art and all those things. Torah, that's the halacha, that's all you need to know. This is Mayim Rishonim, Mayim Achronim. And the intellectual level of the understanding of Torah risks becoming childish and very formal. This is what you do and this is what you don't do and that's it. The Torah is so rich in intellectual understanding, and one needs to apply one's mind to it, and there's so few teachers that are teaching it and places that are emphasizing an understanding of the depths of intellect of what it is that the Torah is teaching us. So if I ask you, what is the connection between these two cases, there's a halachic answer to that. One's Mayim Rishonim, one's Mayim Achronim. One is washing before the meal, one is washing after the meal. QED, it's simple. That doesn't satisfy the mind. That satisfies a mathematical sense of organization. Good, so I've seen some kind of connection. It satisfies a mathematical mind, but it doesn't satisfy an intellectual mind. Conceptually, what is the relationship between these two? And what is the relationship between this Chazal and the other Chazals which comment on what Bilam perceived? These two are very closely connected. Bilam notices a value in halacha which would solve his problem if he could reach that level. What is his problem? The problem of the Western world. The gap between the public and the private lives. Bilam suddenly realizes that the Jews have the answer. Take the Shas Hashmad. In the Shas Hashmad, in the time of decree, nobody is to know, the public is not to know, that I'm a Jew inside. So what do I do? Do I act like a goy outside? No, Bilam understands. I can still act like a Jew and nobody will know. It's still possible. What he discovers here is that when we relate to one another, we don't need to penetrate into the inner beings of the other person. Why do we, in secular society, why is that important? So I deal with a person and he says, good afternoon, how are you? I'm so happy to see you. Please come inside. I hope we can do business together. I've got to be asking myself all the time, is this for real, isn't it? Does he like me or does he hate me? And if he hates me, why is he saying it? Is it just politeness, or does he want to use me in some kind of way? I've got to go through that questioning. Otherwise, I'm not going to survive in the Western world. So I've got to try and understand what's inside him. I've got to try and understand what makes him tick. And so all these pseudo-spiritual sciences or pseudo-scientific spiritualities or spiritual sciences develop. all these psychologies and this and ways of analyzing and figuring what's going on inside him. It's important. We've got to know what's going on inside him. Here we have a restaurateur. He says, I have a problem. I want to supply kosher meat to the population, to the Jewish population, but nobody must know that I'm a kosher restaurateur. That means goyim are going to come in. If goyim come in and I dish them up with kosher meat, I'm going to be executed. So I've got to give the goyim treif, and I've got to give the yid kosher. And if one yid comes in and doesn't eat kosher because of me, that's my responsibility. So I've got to be terribly careful. So to protect my own life, I've got to give the goyim treif, and to protect the Jews, I have to give the Jews kosher. But I have a problem. The Jews don't act like Jews. They act like goyim. How am I going to know who's who? Bilam says to himself, my answer would be I would have to call in psychologists to give me various ways of testing by the way they walk and by the way they talk and by the length of their nose and all sorts of things as to whether they're Jews or whether they're not Jews. He says, Bilam, but these Yidden don't need to get involved in all that. I can tell by certain actions that he does exactly what he is. Do I know what his Yerushalayim is? Do I know if he's a God-fearing man? No, but that's none of my business. Do I know if he's a big Talmid Chochem, if he's just an ordinary Jew? No, but that's none of my business. All I know is that he's a Yid who's medaktik b'halocha. He's a Yid who is meticulous about his observance of Jewish law of the halocha. That's all I know. But that's all I need to know. Do you know what that tells me about a person? If I know nothing more than that he's medaktik b'halocha, I don't know what he thinks of God, and I don't know what God thinks of him. And I don't know what he thinks of his fellow man, and I don't know what his fellow man thinks of him. But I know one thing for sure. This man will not deviate one iota from Shulchan Aruch. Not in the laws of Shabbos, not in the laws of davening, not in the laws of kashrus, not in the laws of marriage, not in the laws of the way he treats his wife, not in the laws of treating his parents and treating his children, not in the laws of treating his community and his society, not in the laws of his business dealing. I know he's going to observe every paragraph of the Shulchan Aruch. Imagine I could know such a thing about a person. Is it necessary for me to know anything more about him? That's all I need to know. That's enough for me to be able to relate to him comfortably in every area, because I know exactly what value system governs him. I don't know what goes on in his heart, but I don't need to know what goes on in his heart. That's none of my business. That, says Bilam, is the beauty of what these Jews have. A means of relating to one another, a means of operating where they are consistent in their public lives in a way which communicates exactly how they're going to operate and how they do operate, and allows their private lives to continue and develop without pressures and without interferences. Because nobody's prying. Nobody needs to know what's inside them. It's none of anybody's business. That's between them and God. In other words, Bilam understands that there is a third dimension in Jewish life, not just the public and the private life. There is exposure to the public, that's number one. There is exposure not to the public, that's number two. And then there is that part of us which is never exposed. What do I mean? Exposure to the public is when other people can see me. Exposure but not to the public is when I act in private. That's not called not exposure. Because Molei Chol Haoretz Kavoda, the Ribbono Shel Olam is there. So whenever I act, I am exposed. The only question is, am I exposed to society, or am I exposed only to God? And then there's that part inside me, my thoughts, my feelings, my emotions, my spiritual status. That's never exposed to anybody, and doesn't need to be exposed to anybody. Says Bilam, so these people have a system of values which is equal in their public exposure and in their private exposure. And more than that, one doesn't need. So what happens to that part of them which is never exposed? That's kept private. They've developed the capacity to operate in public and out of public in one way, and in private just to leave it alone. That inner part of us mustn't be disturbed too much. It needs to grow, it needs to be nurtured, it needs to be left alone a little bit. We need to water it, we need to tend it, but when you plant a seed, if you keep on uncovering the ground to see what the seed is doing, nothing will grow. One has to pour, water it and keep it in the light, but you just have to wait. Only when it comes to the surface do you handle what's on the surface. Then you prune what's on the surface. Then you spray what's on the surface. But you never dig under the roots unless there's a disease. You leave that underground. And so the human being has a whole part of himself which should be left underground. Doesn't need to be pried into. Leave it alone. Then there's the part which is above the ground. His private exposure and his public exposure. But private exposure is also above the ground. And it is governed by the same halacha which governs his public exposure. So in his exposure, I know exactly how this man is going to operate. If we're talking about a person who is medaktek by halacha, who is meticulous in his observance of halacha, I know how he's going to behave in my presence, and I know how he's going to behave in my absence. I don't know what he really thinks of me, but what is that important? I know that if this man is medaktek by halacha says to me, I would like to do business with you, I know that that means exactly what he says, because there's a halacha of midvar sheker tirchak. Distance yourself from dishonesty, and I know that piv v'libo shovim, that there's such a halacha, and he would never say those words if he didn't intend them. Does that mean that he wants to do business with me because he thinks I'm a tzaddik? No. Does that mean that he wants to do business with me because he loves me? No. That might be that he wants to do business with me because he needs me, and when he doesn't need me anymore, he will no longer want to do business. That might be, but I know for one thing for sure, he means what he says. Because I know what governs his actions. Halacha governs his actions. And I'm not interested in his feelings and in his emotions in that sense. I don't have to dig and pry. He'll let me know what I need to know. And what I don't need to know, I don't need to know. He says, Bilam, here you've got a man who needs to know. Now what does he need to know? It's a time of shmad. So in public, nobody's acting like a Jew. So does that mean that he needs to kricht arayin in their souls to know whether they're Jews or not? No. He can still see by their actions. Are they keeping the halachas of shmad? Are they acting like Jews are meant to act in times of shmad? And if they are, they're Jews. And if they're not, they're not Jews. The second story the same. A con man stands outside. What does he thrive on? What does he survive on, the con man? On prying into the intimate details of other people's lives. And trading on those details. That's how he does it. A man who does mayim achronim after his meal denies the con man the opportunity of knowing what he had for lunch. Says Bilam, once again he sees that halacha is a barrier to an invasion of privacy. It's an amazing concept. It allows people to operate with one another with integrity and with depth, but without an abandonment of their own privacy. You come out from lunch and nobody can tell what you had for lunch. It's none of anybody's business. Halacha has denied the con man the opportunity of prying into his personal life. And this, of course, is just an image, it's just an example. In this, Bilam sees a whole system of apparently little halachas. But he says when you tie all these little halachas together, it's a system of life. And what that system enables one to achieve is the operation in a society consistently, with stability, and without interference from others. Because we have another problem. The inside is not always stable. We're governed by moods, we're governed by our ups and downs, sometimes we feel more spiritual, sometimes we feel less spiritual. And this puts a certain stress on people. If we're going to use the American system, then you never know where you stand with a person. If he feels like working with you today, then he'll work with you. If he doesn't feel like it, he won't. And you'll phone him up and say, where were you today? He said, I didn't feel like working with you. Take it or leave it. That's how I am. You better get used to it. So where do you stand with such a man? And tomorrow, if I feel like it, I'll be there. If I don't feel like it, I won't. One can't operate like that. If one goes the other side, if one goes to the continental side, then the public life is consistent, the way they operate in public is consistent, but you never know what's going on in the private side. Never know. Up and down. But with Am Yisrael, there's another situation, and that is the public is constant, and the private, the exposed privacy, is also constant. Because halacha governs them both. And the moods oscillate, that's true, but the moods don't affect anything that the person acts in. Any area in which the person acts in, any area of his conduct, are totally protected from his moods. No matter how he feels, he's up in the morning and his Kriya Shema and his talus and his tefillin, no matter how he feels, he washes before his meal, he says his bracha, he benches at the end of it, it makes no difference how he feels. So we've removed the whole area of the human being's interrelationships between man and God and between man and man from the area of his own moods. And we've given them stability and consistency. And we've taken the privacy, the private part, and said, just forget about it. Just leave it alone. And then what happens to the private part? What happens to that inside, which has its ups and downs, that inside which nobody penetrates to because it's nobody's business? That develops. There's a remarkable psychologist at my table last night who suggested that part of the reason that Bilam became cognizant of the value of the Jewish people, he changed, as we mentioned in the shiur last night, midway. Part of the reason might have been because he'd gotten used to blessing them. It's behaviorism, she said. He was forced to bless them. God forced him. Over and over again he blessed them. But that action of blessing him over and over again aroused inside him a true feeling of valuing them. And that sense of behaviorism in that sense is very much in accordance with Torah beliefs. That our actions, even if they are forced actions, even if they are actions of compulsion, do affect the way we feel inside. And Bilam notices that once you've put yourself into the stable framework, where no matter what your moods and no matter whether you're up or down, there's a certain consistency, people know where they stand with you, God knows where he stands with you. Shmad or no shmad, you wash before the meal, that's no problem. You say your bracha, you might say it very quietly, you might mumble it. But the man who has his eyes open knows that you're a Jew and he can see that you're a Jew. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. Your Jewishness remains because it's so ingrained, it's so routine, it's so constant. And so the man who's just had his meal, it doesn't matter what kind of a rush he's in, it doesn't matter. Nobody else will know what he's eating for lunch. That's nobody's business. And you won't see it on his fingers. He does his Mayim Achronim, no matter how much of a hurry he is in. No matter how he feels. The halachas, even the little halachas, are kept constantly. This Bilam, this eventually affects the insides too. And there is a certain consistency and a certain stability even in the inside. But that doesn't matter. That's not even what we're concerned with. And that ties to Bilam's observation that the tents of Klal Yisrael don't open towards one another. You can't see into another person's tent. Total privacy. That's what he admires. Total inner privacy. And yet, Shoichein Lishvotov, they reside in tribes, they interrelate, they cooperate, they operate as a society, not as a group of individuals. How do they do that? Such privacy! And yet they interrelate with such social correctness and with such social harmony and genuineness. That's halacha, says Bilam. Halacha governs their every move, and that enables them to operate in a society with reliability. You know what to expect from the other person. You know what to expect from yourself. You know what he expects from you. All that he expects is the Shulchan Aruch. If you're in any doubt, you open the Shulchan Aruch, you look up, you know what you're expected to do. Simple. The feeling I put into it, that's my own business. The kavonas I put into it, that's my own business. The particular style with which I do it, that's my own business. But everybody keeps that same halacha. And we know where we stand. And so Bilam perceives this combination of sophisticated social interrelationship and yet total privacy. And he is jealous. Because that is his problem. He has these two lives, and he cannot reconcile them. That consistency is so important. Consistency in the little things. And that's the point of these midrashim. Bilam didn't notice the big things, the big acts of Mesirus Nefesh, the outstanding acts of spiritual achievement. What he noticed was the consistency, the continuity, the regularity, the absolute faithfulness to this system of behavior. A system of behavior which governed them in public and which governed them in private. And a system of behavior which was so all-encompassing, nothing is left to mood. Nothing. A lot is left to individuality, sure. Each person has different thoughts when he does his mitzvah. But nothing is left to mood. And when nothing is left to mood, there is no need to pry into privacy. No need at all. And once there's no prying into privacy, there is a retention of privacy. And that's something that one has to develop, that reliability to know what one expects. A person comes, is in davening one day, is not in davening the next day. Someone goes and says, "Are you all right?" That's already an invasion of privacy, really. It's none of your business. If he wasn't, he would say so. He might not want you to be inquiring what's going on. But what can you do? You don't know how else to relate to him because his actions are functions of his mood. One day he keeps Shabbos, the next day he doesn't keep Shabbos. A couple of weeks go by and he's learning Torah every day and he's at every shiur and he's learning Chavrusa. A week later you never see him. What's happening? What is it? It needs one to pry. The natural response is, what's going on? But maybe he doesn't want anybody to know what's going on. And what about the person who's always there, consistently, doesn't deviate, slowly builds up, every time the same? He has a shield. You know that you can crack a joke with him and he's not going to get faribled. Then you have the unstable person. One day you get on fine and everything's okay. The next day you relate to him in exactly the same way and he takes offense at you. You don't know where to stand. So you've either got to pry to figure out what makes him tick, or you've got to back off. You've got to leave him alone. Not so where there's consistency. Consistency of conduct at least. Not consistency of mood. Forget the moods. The moods are nobody's business. But at least consistency of conduct. Then the message I'm putting out to you is, you don't have to worry about my moods. They're my business. I've got to cope with them. I'm going to handle them. I have ups and downs like we all do. Don't worry about them. You won't detect it in my reliability. You won't detect it in my behavior. No matter what I feel like, this is what you can expect from me. This is what you'll get from me. What the Shulchan Aruch says is what I do, and you don't have to worry. And immediately there's a relaxed relationship which leaves the person intact. Very, very special. Very foreign to our way of thinking, but very, very special. And very intimate. It enables people to become intimate with one another without becoming too intimate with one another. That's one of the standard fears, you know, they always give the example of people in a lift that don't speak to one another. Why don't they speak to one another? Because they're too close. There comes a time when you're too close, anything can be offensive. So you back off. With the halachic routine, as the Midrash describes it, there's no problem. You're never too close, so you can always be intimate. There's always the natural distance, yet the natural intimacy at the same time, which gives the person the ability to interrelate openly, and at the same time, not to pry into private areas. Quite amazing. This might be a very high level to reach emotionally and psychologically. Most of us might be a little immature emotionally. And we sometimes like to have tantrums, and we, if nobody knows about our tantrum, it loses all the fun. The whole purpose of having the tantrum is that one gets a little bit of attention, that one gets a little bit of notice. There's no point in having a private tantrum. And we expect somebody to come and say, "Why weren't you there yesterday? What's the matter, my friend? Are you okay? Everything all right? I'm sure everything's okay. Do you need anything?" Then the person feels a little bit better. We are emotionally immature. And so we have these needs. What the Medrash is describing is the way we're supposed to be, not the way we are. The way where we're all able to cope with our private lives, ourselves. We need one another to cope with our social lives, with our professional lives, with our Torah lives. That's where we need one another. To cope with our ups and downs, that we should be able to do ourselves. And that's at least the area and the direction to which we have to strive to be able to reach that ability. What does Bilam do about all this? He's noticed a remarkable thing. He's understood in one glance an entire aspect of Shmiras HaHalachi. He understands the whole concept of Naaseh V'Nishma. We will do and then we will study. Our understanding and our feeling for the mitzvahs will not, or rather our actions, our conduct, our practice of the mitzvahs will not be affected by our moods, by the level of our understanding. No, Naaseh comes first. That's the kli, that's the framework in which we operate. The Shulchan Aruch is the framework in which we operate irrespective of what's happening. Now that we've got the framework, we will understand and we will try and feel and we will put in intentions and we will learn and we will try and improve our moods. We'll do all sorts of emotional things within that framework, but the framework is defined. And Bilam understands that. I would expect him to convert on the spot. And he almost does. He says an amazing phrase. Tomois nafshi mois yeshurim usehi acharisi komoyu. Says Bilam, to live like the Jews, I can't. It's beyond me. But I would love to die like them. If I could die with that stability, and thus be assured of an acharis, of a world to come, such as the world to come that is set aside for them, that would be special for me. But I cannot live that way. What is the end of such a man? He dies eventually, of course. And then what? We're fortunate enough to know a little bit about Bilam's afterlife too. When Unculus was considering converting, before he began to convert, Gemara in Gittin says, he went to a spiritualist and he consulted various people who had lived their lives and were now up in heaven, where all is clear. And who could be more authoritative to consult than people who were now in the Olam HaEmes and had lived their lives? So he calls up various people. One of the people he calls up is Bilam. And he says to Bilam, which is the nation that is the most important, the most prominent? And Bilam says, the Jews. And Unculus says, what should I do to connect myself to them? And Bilam says, I have nothing to do with them. They're harmful, they're dangerous, they're negative. Even in Olam HaEmes, Bilam couldn't overcome his prejudices. One thinks that at least up there one gets it right. Not necessarily so. Bilam goes through his Olam HaEmes, still clinging to his hatred of the Jewish people. Although he perceived what he did, and although he craved to die like a Jew, but since he wasn't prepared to live like a Jew, he never acquires even a touch of real understanding of what it's all about. The Gemara goes on to say, our versions are slightly censored. Our version says he then consulted sinners of Israel. But the old version of the Gemara says he then consulted Jesus, a sinner of Israel, and asked him, who is the most prominent nation in the world? And he said, the Jewish people. And he said, what about attaching myself to him? And he advised him to do so. And the Gemara concludes by saying, look at the difference between a sinner, but he's Jewish, to a prophet who's a goy. Bilam the prophet, such a high stature, but he didn't have that inner soul that was able, at least in Olam HaEmes, to see the truth and to acknowledge it. Jesus was a sinner. He did some terrible things. But he comes to the Olam HaEmes and he's able to see the truth there, because he's a Jew. Underneath it all, he's got that ability to confront it, to be confronted with the truth and to recognize it and to see it. But not Bilam. That's a little bit of insight into our friend Bilam. The enormity of his intellect, the depth of his perception, what he sees, this gleaning of an understanding of this aspect of halacha comes from Bilam. Chazal reports to us what Bilam perceived, and look how beautiful it is. This understanding, so deep, so difficult. I'm sure it's something I'll have to work over in future shiurim again. To put it over clearly, I don't think it's possible to put it over in one shiur. This understanding of the halachic mechanism of handling the dichotomy between the public and the private life, protecting privacy from the public eye in a way which retains integrity and reliability. All this is perceived by Bilam. Bilam understands that that's the way to die. The way to go to the Olam HaEmes is dying as a Jew. But not to live as a Jew, that he can't bring himself to do it. And in so doing, or not doing, he sacrifices his opportunity of perceiving some kind of truth, even in the Olam HaEmes, even in the world to come. Not so the Jew. No matter how far he's wandered off, always has the opportunity and always has the possibility of bringing himself back to that point of truth, of understanding that the framework has to be there. All the philosophy is wonderful and all the psychology is wonderful and all the emotions are lovely, but at the end of the day, the framework has to be there. The framework is the Torah, the framework is the Shulchan Aruch, the framework is Halacha. That's where the Jew expresses himself. That's the way in which the Jew operates. And that's the way in which we understand one another and respect one another. Respect one another's public image and respect one another's privacy.